Okay, it is October 4th, 2017. The NL wildcard game is blowing our minds right now. Big shout out to Archie Bradley. And the AL Division Series both start tomorrow, and we're here to preview that, aren't we, Josh?
Yes, we are. I mean, I don't know if you heard our original predictions for the first two wild card games, but we're really good at this, so you should totally take what we say and go with it.
Yeah, all seven of our fans heard it, and we actually did pretty well, except for that first inning in the first wild card game. And nobody listened to our second wild card prediction, so for as far as you people know, we did great on that one too. Don't look it up. So we've got the Red Sox and the Astros tomorrow, or at least when you're going to be listening to this today, at 3 p.m. Central Time. We've got the Indians, the mighty Indians, and the Yankees playing tomorrow night, tonight, when you're going to be listening to this. Josh, when do you say we go with the first game for the first series first?
Let's do it.
So we got the Astros and the Red Sox. Why don't we tell the folks how these two teams got here? Who do you want to take?
So I can talk about the Astros a little bit. So, obviously they were kind of in the category of the Dodgers as being one of the two best teams, just jumping out with a huge lead in terms of best record in their league. I mean, it was the Dodgers at one point in the National League. It was the Astros in the American League before the Indians went on their kind of miracle run at the end of the season. But I mean, basically everyone who, bought themselves a copy of Sports Illustrated in 2017 and saw the prophecy that was the Astros winning the 2017 World
In
Series.
20, what, 13?
It might have been 2013, yeah. It's looking pretty good right now. It's looking like it's, the opposite of a Sports Center, Sports Illustrated curse. So, this is a team that finished 101 and 61, so 40 games above 500. This is a team that has a great young core hitting wise, super strong up the middle when you look at Jose Altuve, Carlos Correa, and then George Springer in center field. So you have a team that looks like it's going to be strong. I hate to say this because we've seen it before, but looks like they're going to be in the playoffs plenty of times, but has a very, 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 very good chance to actually make that prophecy come true.
Yeah, they're a really exciting young team. They're one of the squads that when your team isn't playing that day, or maybe they have a game later in the day or earlier in the day all season long, they were one of the go-to teams where if you didn't have a prior obligation and you wanted to watch baseball, if an Astros game was on, you're tuning in. Or at least that's how it was for me.
No, I'd
when it
agree
was
with that.
when the Red Sox weren't playing. Speaking of the Red Sox, their opponent in the division series had finished with a record of 93 and 69. Hashtag nice. Yeah, the Red Sox are who we thought they were coming into the season. Their offense struggled without David Ortiz in the lineup. Last year they led the league in runs scored, not so much this year, but they were one of the top defensive teams in baseball. They were led by a collection of really talented young guys with B names, and they had Chris Sale at the top of the lineup, or at the top of the rotation, putting in a Cy Young worthy performance. It's up in the air as to whether it's going to be him or Kluber, based on the way Kluber closed out the season. But Chris Sale was absolutely dominant almost all year long. And if he does end up being the Cy Young, he'd be a very, very deserving one. 300 strikeouts, which I think has only happened once or twice twice before in Red Sox history.
I mean, the last time it happened was when Pedro Martinez, pitching god himself, did it.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty rarefied air to put yourself in your first season with the Red Sox. They did have a number of things go wrong this year. In particular, the long-term injuries to two of them, to David Price. He was injured at the start of the season with an elbow issue, but he came back because of his magical self-healing elbow. And then the elbow started acting up, and he missed almost all of August. I think he did miss all of August and almost all of September, but he came back, and he looked really good out of the bullpen where he's going to be pitching in the playoffs. They also had some significant regression from guys. In particular, my man Rick Porcello, 2016 AL Cy Young winner, was pretty mediocre, to say the least, this year. And they saw regression from all of their young stars, including Jackie Bradley Jr., Mookie Betts, and Xander Bogaerts, who really kind of fortified the lineup last year around David Ortiz.
Yeah, I think the Red Sox, I mean, don't get me wrong, like, we knew they were going to be a good team coming in, but we knew it would be kind of a battle in terms of the AL East this year with the much improved competition that they were facing. You know, obviously the Yankees, who made it to the playoffs and advanced past the wild card. But, I mean, they had two big things that were kind of working against them. David Ortiz retiring, who, you know, obviously, you know, when the Yankees and Jeter retired, you know, it was kind of one of those, like, hey, we hate to see you go, but good riddance because you haven't been hurting our team. Whereas David Ortiz was pretty valuable up until he decided to actually hang it up. So there was a big bat to have to replace there, and it's hard to kind of just – recreate that offensive production. Whereas on the other side, when you look at it, David Price, who had managed to be incredibly healthy for most of his career, decided that this was the year where it was totally fine to not go out there and throw 200 innings, and he suffered through some injuries, and you had that loss of production that you were expecting to get from him. So, you know, it's a testament to how good the young guys are on the team that they're still here, that they were able to pick up the slack. But it does show that there is a bit of a hole that you can find on the team that you might see play a factor when it comes to this playoff series. What do you think?
I think that's definitely true. One of the things that's striking to me about this playoff series is how similar these two teams are. They both have two very good pitchers leading the way. I think the Astros are better, obviously, with Verlander and Keuchel. But the Red Sox got a tremendous season from Drew Pomeranz and obviously the aforementioned Chris Sale. They both are led by cores of young, incredibly talented all-star caliber players. They both have dominant bullpens. They both play great defense. I think the key difference between these two teams is the Astros scored runs like nobody's business and just socked the ball everywhere. And the Red Sox just did not.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it a little bit later when we break down some of these lineups, but the Houston Astros were offensively one of the best, if not the best team this year. I know the Dodgers had their hot run, but in terms of strikeout percentage, nobody was better at not striking out than the Houston Astros, which I think is actually a pretty valuable trait to have in this strikeout happy era, while they also managed to finish second in total home runs over the season, meaning that, you know, not only were they able to make contact with the ball, they were able to make pretty solid contact with the ball. So that's something that I think is going to be to their advantage in a series, but obviously matchups are going to play a key.
Speaking of matchups, why don't we run down the makeups of these teams and figure out what kind of matchups are going to happen and who's going to have advantages in certain areas. How's that?
Sounds good.
So starting with the lineups, we already mentioned both teams are led by young guns. Red Sox, just did it again. Red Sox led by the killer bees of Jackie Bradley Jr., Mookie Betts, Andrew Benintendi, and Xander Bogaerts, as well as the rookie Rafael Devers, who really filled in their disastrous third base situation quite nicely.
What was a black hole before Rafael Devers came through, yeah.
And the Astros pretty much have youth at every position. They've got Carlos Correa, who looks like he's going to be a superstar, George Springer, who could be a superstar, Jose Altuve, who's already a superstar.
Yeah, but then you expand. You look on, too, when you go to like somebody like Keuchel, who's still in his 20s. You look at somebody like Gurriel, who's a valuable piece that they have, even Marwin Gonzalez or Josh Reddick. Just great depth pieces that they have on their team that are still quite young. I mean, we're not talking about like these high paid veterans that they're you know, having to really expect to get their value back on. No, I mean, they're getting guys who are young, on the cheap, and being able to produce at a high level.
And you didn't even mention Alex Bregman and Derek Fisher.
Exactly.
Derek Fisher has had some nice at-bats, although I'm not sure what his ceiling is going to be long-term. Anyway, looking at these two lineups, who do you think has the advantage? I know that the answer here is pretty obvious.
Yeah, I think if you're looking straight at the offensive aspect of the game, I think you're going to be leaning towards the Houston Astros. The combination of young talent, their core, and the ability of what they have, matched up with the depth and, you know, just being able to kind of lean on certain veterans like Evan Gattis out of the DH slot. You don't really have to ask too much of him, but you know that he can give you good pop. Something similar with Brian McCann, who was a great hitter when he was younger. You know, those flashes come through us sometime. And just the ability for them to kind of mix and match and pull off the bench whenever they need to, I think lends the advantage to the Houston Astros in this series.
I agree. I absolutely agree, and it pains me to say it as a Red Sox fan. One thing I will say, if the Red Sox do have a shot in to win this series, we already mentioned them, the Killer Bees have to hit, and they're certainly capable of doing that. They've all been, well, Benintendi, I don't think has been. Benintendi hasn't been an all-star yet. But Bogarts, Betts, and Bradley Jr. have all played in the all-star game, and they've all regressed terribly this season. Bogarts and Bradley Jr. both finished with sub-100 WRCS+, which is yours and mine, my favorite stat to predict or to describe offensive performance.
Big fan.
Bogarts was a 96 WRC plus this year, 115 last year. Bradley Jr. was a 90 WRC plus this year, 119 last year. Betts had a 108 WRC plus, which is basically just average. And he was a 137 last year. Benintendi, 103. Although I'm not going to hurt him too much because he only played 37 last year, but he was a 122 in 2016.
I mean, when I look at that, I think what's interesting about it is the fact that, you know, hey, look, these are young guys. There is a chance that they're going to regress a little bit, and that's what we've seen this year. But I think also the fact that they've shown the ability to hit at that level. Like, remember, I mean, you know, we keep mentioning about the playoffs, but it's something that you really need to keep in mind when you're looking at some of these stats is that when you shrink the sample size from 162 to 7 or to 5 in this case, like, it makes for those random fluctuations to be much more pronounced. And so it's been shown that these guys can hit. Like, they're very good hitters. And if they're in situations where they get ahead of the count, like, it's very possible for them to be able to put together, you know, 3 or 4 games of really great at-bats and be able to kind of just become an offensive juggernaut that we expected from them last year.
Exactly. I think another thing to keep in mind is that they're very streaky hitters. Bogarts dominated at the beginning of the year and then fell off after he had some nitpicky injuries. He had problems with his hands and with his oblique. Bradley Jr. basically just started striking out a ton. Betts didn't hit for as much power, which is the biggest explanation in his drop, and his BABIP kind of cratered. But all of them are capable of putting together short stretches and have in the past, where they've absolutely been dominant. So if you're looking for a reason, if you're a Red Sox fan, to be hopeful in this series, it's not only that these guys are capable of stringing together stretches where they can dominate a game, they've done it before. Another thing to keep in mind is the way the Red Sox score runs versus the way the Astros score runs. If I'm not mistaken, the Astros led the league or were in the top of the league in home runs, weren't they?
They were right there at second place, right behind the Yankees.
The Red Sox were dead last. So the way the Red Sox score runs across the season this year, at least with this team without David Ortiz, is by stringing hits together, which can, depending on how you look at it, can be either be an advantage or a disadvantage in the playoffs. I tend to lean toward it being a disadvantage unless you are a group of seasoned hitters. But if you think Bradley Jr. bats ninth, and then you have Betts first, Betts or Bogarts first, Benintendi second, and then Betts or Bogarts third, when you get those four guys coming together, if all four of them are hitting, then you're going to be see them drive in a lot of runs in cycles.
See, and that's where I'm pretty interested, because the fact that the Astros are a team that can go out there and mash the ball a little bit, I think you can actually look at it and, you know, let's look at the projected starting lineup for the Red Sox and kind of see, you know, is this a team that's, you know, going to give up a ton of home runs? And unfortunately, it looks like that might be the case. Not that you would expect it to happen, but that it's very plausible that it could happen. I mean, Chris Sale, he has some interesting struggles in his career. For whatever reason, September seems to be the month that, you know, he just seems to kind of slip a little bit and decide to give up a couple gopher balls. We know that the game two starter is going to be Drew Pomeranz. This is a dude who, man, when he spots up and when he decides to, you know, hit his pitches and hit his spots, I mean, he's tough to hit. It's unreal. The movement he gets, it's fantastic. But he also doesn't have the overpowering stuff to be able to afford to miss. He has a smaller margin of error. So this is the same dude where if he decides to miss over the plate, like, you're going to see a lot of gopher balls knocked over the wall. So it's something where you need them to be on the top of their game to make sure that they can control this Houston Astros offense.
Yeah, this is an interesting transition to me, because the pitching, starting pitching matchups, again, this is very similar, where both teams, as I mentioned before, have definite one and two starters, and it's unclear who's going to go next. But again, this is a situation where it looks like the Astros probably have an advantage. So the first game is going to be Sale versus Verlander. And it's really a question in my mind of, what do you believe is the truer pitcher? Is it Justin Verlander in the first half versus Justin Verlander in the second half? Or Chris Sale in the first half versus Chris Sale in the second half? Justin Verlander was dominant with the Astros and very average with the Tigers. Chris Sale was dominant all the way through August, and he really struggled in September. He started to give up home runs. He started to miss his spots and walk guys. So if Chris Sale can pull it together on a moment's notice, he's going to be tough to beat. And the Red Sox have gotten to Justin Verlander in the playoffs in the past with this group of guys. On the flip side, there is something to be said about rhythm.
Yep. I would agree with that. Now, this is where I'm going to call on my insider, you know, insider info a little bit, and the tangential knowledge that I have with Justin Verlander and his time with the Tigers. You know, it's funny. Like, I think we think of starting pitchers as kind of the same way as we look at wide receivers, as being divas, you know, when it comes to their sport. And I think that could apply to Justin Verlander, but I don't think it necessarily is a bad thing. I think it's one of those where, you know, he's motivated by being in a situation where he can go out there and prove how valuable he is to the team and prove his worth. And I think the ability to go to a contender where he's actually able to compete for a World Series, or at least be the playoffs, which he hasn't been able to do with the Tigers since, 2013. But it's been a while since he's been able to compete and play on a competitive team. And I think the ability to move him to a team where all of his starts matter, all of his starts are reliant on how he plays and how much he can help the team, I think that's been a big factor in motivating him to, you know, kind of regain that old Justin Verlander form that we all expected. At the same time, I mean, Chris Sale, when you look at, you know, his September struggles, he's always been in one of two positions. Well, actually, he's always been in one position, and that's with the White Sox, and that's looking at a September and realizing that these games don't matter. And so even this year, you know, being with the Red Sox, it was kind of one of those where they weren't really guaranteed to make the playoffs, but they were all but guaranteed to make the playoffs. And so it kind of sucks the wind out of the idea of, like, hey, you need to go out there and do this. And plus, I think there is something to be said of having to face a bunch of rookie hitters that you don't have any information on besides the fact of don't throw it down the middle. It does make it a little bit harder to have sustained success. And so I'm not necessarily really worried when you see a pitcher kind of has struggles in September, because at that point you're kind of like, okay, I mean, he's about 6 months in now. It's kind of hard to stay focused, and, you know, he might be a little bit tired. Whereas I think when you give him the opportunity to go start pitching in October, it'll be very easy for him to dial back in and make good pitches.
So in the second game, we've got Pomeranz versus Keuchel, and this is a matchup with Dallas Keuchel, who's been one of the most dominant pitchers in the game over the last couple of years, and Drew Pomeranz, who has been your classic Jekyll and Hyde type pitcher. When he's on, he is one of the most interesting pitchers to watch, at least from the perspective of pitching nerds like myself, because he's really coming out there throwing two pitches, a fastball, which does not have great power. He brings it in 93, 94, but it's got great spin rate, which can make it deceptive. And he's got a brilliant curveball, again, with great spin rate, that he uses to keep hitters off balance. And if he's hitting his spots, he becomes very tough to hit, generates a lot of strikeouts and a lot of ground balls. But on the flip side, when he's not hitting his spots, he can be very, very bad.
And that's the risk you take, especially going up against this Houston Astros lineup. But I think there's something to be said for the starting rotations. But I think another key in this game is obviously when you get past the starting rotations, get to the bullpens. I think it's an interesting dynamic between the two teams. You have one team where they have probably one of the best relievers in the game. And, you know, Craig Kimbrell for the Red Sox has been fantastic. I mean, he's been lights out. I think we all kind of forgot about it because he happened to have a couple bad years in there. But the form he showed this year has been pretty close to the top form he showed when he was back in Atlanta. But at the same time, I think when you look at the units as a whole, the unit that you want to go for is the Houston Astros. Yeah, with the ability to throw Chris Devinsky, being able to throw Ken Giles, who's fantastic. Luke Gregerson has been fantastic for them. I think also what's interesting is they managed to go out and pick up a Tyler Clipper. They also managed to go up and pick up Francisco Liriano. They also have a Joe Musgrove, who's been super effective for them. So they have a lot of arms out there that, as a collective unit, I think will serve them well over a 7-game series instead of kind of relying on your closer to come in and shut down every game, right?
And on the Red Sox side, they've got a great bullpen, too, beyond Craig Kimbrell. Theirs is built in a more interesting way, though, in that it's, other than the trade acquisition in Addison Reed and the recently called up Carson Smith, their best relievers outside of Craig Kimbrell are two converted starters, one in Joe Kelly, who's been electric out of the bullpen, throwing 100-mile-an-hour two-seamers.
That'll play.
And David Price.
I think David Price is a very interesting piece for the Red Sox because I think they're going to have the chance to use him and utilize him as a Andrew Miller type piece where you can kind of deploy him whenever the going gets tough. What do you think?
Yeah, I've been calling that role swingman. Kind of come in and take over a game that's starting to get away from a starting pitcher and shut it down and kind of extend those innings maybe from the fifth into the sixth and seventh.
I'd agree with that. I think that's a great way to describe it.
He's kind of he's got that skill set. He's a guy who probably, his stuff is probably more better suited to a bullpen role because he really only throws two pitches. He's a fastball changeup guy, and he's got a show me breaking ball, but it's really the fastball and the changeup. But his command and his pitching knowledge is so good that he's been able to leverage that to a unbelievable yell. I mean, you want a Cy Young as a starter, but I think he has the makeup to be really dominant out of the bullpen.
I think if you can look at the idea of, you know, having that just safety piece in David Price, and just having somebody like a Joe Kelly who you would expect would be able to come in and get yourself a ground ball if you really, 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 really needed one, I think kind of helps to even the tables out. The problem is we're kind of thinking hypotheticals, and we haven't necessarily seen that happen, whereas I feel a little bit more confident with the Astros bullpen because they've effectively been doing it all year.
Absolutely. We were talking about X factors for the series, things that could swing it. With the Astros, you mentioned that they don't strike out.
I think that's a big key. I think the interesting thing to look here is that the Astros were literally the team with the lowest K percentage in their at-bats. And they're going to be going up against a bunch of K arms that produce a lot of strikeouts. I mean, most effectively, obviously, Chris Sale. But, you know, hey, when Drew Pomerantz is on and when he's able to spot the pitches where he wants, he can produce Ks. I think when you look at somebody like a Craig Kimbrell out of the bullpen, or David Price, if he decides to, you know, be David Price, those are guys who can produce a lot of strikeouts as well. And so I think the interesting thing for the Astros is, you know, how much do you change the approach? Are you trying to hit a bunch of home runs? Are you trying to hit the ball hard? Or are you sticking with the idea of, hey, don't let the pitcher beat you? And I think, you know, when you're looking at a young team, which is, this is their first time really, you know, in the playoffs as like a favorite, as somebody who's expected to make it to the playoff, expected to make it to the World Series. I think there's going to be a little pressure there for some guys to try and sit there and be the hero, and you might see that K number tally up a lot quicker than you want. If the Astros are going to win, they got to make sure that Chris Sale doesn't leave this series with, what, 25, 26 total strikeouts?
Yeah, that would be a that would be a death knell for the Astros. On the Red Sox side, it's hard to find an exact X factor for a team that kind of scrapped together their way to 93 wins. But I think the X factor for them might be that very scrappiness. The Red Sox were 22-19 in one-run games and 15-3 in extra innings. That's not a great winnings percentage in one-run games, but in 41, to have the experience of playing 41 games that were decided by one run and dominating so much in extras, a lot of that is can be subscribed down to luck, but I think a lot of that too is just the makeup of the team and the way they score runs. They're all tough outs. They work counts, and they string together hits, which can be a lot more reliable, especially when going up against fireballing bullpen arms in extra innings.
Yeah, I think the ability to kind of create runs when you need to. I mean, I know baseball is kind of getting away from it. We're saying, hey, the long play, hit home runs, is better over a full season. But hey, you know, when you get into these short game series, you know, there are going to be situations where you need to create runs, and I think the Red Sox ability to be able to do that and do that efficiently is could potentially play pretty huge for them.
So there's another series we got to talk about starting tomorrow night, tonight, between the Indians of Cleveland and the Yankees of the Bronx, New York. Yankees obviously just won their wild card game against the Twins. Josh, this one seems pretty obvious. Why don't you talk us through how the Indians got to this point?
Well, yeah, it's pretty interesting with the Indians. I mean, we all are going to make note of the historic winning streak that they were able to put up at the end of August into September, and kind of how they were able to turn it on at the end of the season. But it is important to note that, like, this was the same team that was kind of struggling at the beginning of the season and was tied up in that AL Central that was for a long time looking very, very, very average until they were able to separate themselves. The calling card for the Cleveland Indians has definitely been the pitching. I mean, the ability to throw Kluber out there, to throw Cookie Carrasco out there, and then also a Trevor Bauer, also a Mike Clevenger, and then, of course, the you know, the death bullpen that they have has really made Cleveland what looks to be a tough out here in the playoffs.
Yeah, and there's really no nice way to put this for Yankee fans. The Indians are just better than they are in almost every facet of the game. The Yankees are obviously a better home run hitting team, but the Indians have really been able to dominate by being able to do it all, as they say, in the last few months of the season. Especially at the catcher position, where Yan Gomes and Roberto Perez played like all-stars, both of them, down the stretch.
Yeah, I mean, for the Indians, the catcher position was kind of the biggest hole that they had. I mean, you could look up and down that lineup, and especially playing in the American League where there's a DH, like, and of course where they're able to throw out Edwin Encarnacion, like, the catcher position was one position where you were kind of like, oh, this is slightly below average, right? Well, guess what? When they decided to go on that winning streak, and then for the month of September, and then for part of the month of August, that catcher position was one of the best hitting positions in baseball. I mean, both of those guys decided to turn it on for a small sample size, but still a very good indicator of the hitting talent that is there, especially when this entire team is firing and there's no easy outs. I mean, they're going to be getting fastballs, and they prove that they can be able to hit that. I think you've also been able to see that with some of the young guys they have on the team, like Yandy Diaz, who came up and was able to inject some instant offense into the lineup, and that just happens to be because, like, hey, look, the rest of that lineup's pretty good. There's no easy out. You have to go at this guy. And guess what? Major league hitters can hit fastballs in the zone. That's just what that's what they're trained to do. They're good at it.
So we know how the Yankees got here. They survived the torrent of mediocrity that was the AL wildcard race, and then they beat up on the Twins last night in the Bronx. Well, two nights ago, if you're listening to this podcast. So what do you say we get right into it? In the lineup matchup, the big guns for the Yankees, we already know, Gary Sanchez, Aaron Judge, Didi Gregorius, and Todd Frazier. But they've also got a few other young guys in there. Jacoby Ellsbury and Brett Gardner both played well down the stretch. And Greg Bird looks like he's going to be something at first base. But as we said, the Indians are rolling out Francisco Lindor, who's been plain and simple the best shortstop in baseball this year, as well as Jose Ramirez, who I think is probably the best player in the series, Jason Kipnis, they picked up Jay Bruce, and we already mentioned Encarnacion, Diaz, Santana, Urshela, and Jackson.
Well, the Yankees, I mean, we weren't really surprised by the home run output that happened on Monday night, because, I mean, they're playing in Yankee Stadium, which is historically a pretty good stadium to hit home runs in. They always talk about the quote-unquote jet stream that's up there, especially when you're going to right field. Playing at Cleveland is going to be a different beast, though, because we've kind of seen that's kind of an average offensive environment. They're right by the lake, so it's a little bit more of a humid environment. Also, it's a little bit colder, so the ball's not going to fly nearly as much, so you're going to have to see a lot of guys make sure they make good contact and bang the ball around the park instead of just kind of relying on the home run ball that you can kind of do when you're in Yankee Stadium. You know, I think the phrase is elevate and celebrate. It's a little bit harder to do once you're in Cleveland playing in that neutral run environment. I think that's why you can look at this and look at the starting rotations of both teams and kind of see where the advantage falls towards Cleveland, because we're looking at Trevor. Actually, I want to ask you about this. How intrigued are you by the idea of Trevor Bauer starting game one so that Corey Kluber could pitch in game two and game five?
So we might as well get into starting rotations right now, because I think we're both in agreement that the Indians have the better top to bottom lineup.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a pretty clear advantage there.
I have been a believer for a long time that Terry Francona is the best manager in baseball, not only in man management, but in his tactics, if you will. He does tend to play it safe with your things like hit and runs and bunting, etc. But we're not old guys. We don't need to see that. I think this is a brilliant move. Kluber will be able to pitch on full day's rest and go twice in the division series. He trusts Bauer. Bauer's had a great year. And he's going to get Carrasco. And he's going to get Carrasco in game three. So you have your two best pitchers going two and three, even if Bauer doesn't pull out a game one win at home. So I think this is a brilliant move by Terry Francona. There will be some question as to who goes in game four. Yeah, my guess is it's going to be Mike Clevinger, but this is going to really maximize the usefulness of that red-hot Indian starting rotation.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Francona is one of those guys that does a very good job of being a player's manager, but also being kind of open to the new information that's available to everybody in the advanced StatCast era. I think the ability to have Trevor Bauer go in game one so that you can kind of understand who you want to use in game four, whether it be Bauer again, if you see that there's a matchup favorability, or try and, you know, change it up, provide a new look for the team, and have Mike Clevinger go in game four. I think the Indians are kind of sitting pretty with that option in their starting rotation, whereas the Yankees, it's pretty obvious which direction they're going to go.
Right. So with the Yankees, we're going to see Tanaka and Gray. What I'm most interested in with the Yankees rotation, though, is how's Luis Severino, who was their best pitcher all year, going to bounce back from his absolute disaster of a start in the AL wildcard game?
See, I'm always intrigued by this because while a one-game playoff is what I would describe as an extreme baseball environment. Yeah, exactly.
Environment.
I think it's a very interesting idea to kind of pull your guy before you have any idea how your offense is looking. You know what I mean? So if I'm Joe Girardi and I'm looking at the fact that I'm going up against Urban Santana, who, while being a pretty good pitcher, isn't somebody who you expect to go up here and throw no hitters at any moment. To make the decision to kind of switch away from your guy before you even get the chance to hit, seems like it's a rash move, seems like it's a quote-unquote desperate move, but just kind of seems like it's a move that's made before you have full information is really what I would go after. But I think Severino, you know, he got it out of his system. There's no way it could get any worse than that. I think he'll be able to kind of settle in and, you know, work more down in the zone because – you know, looking through these two playoff games, the two young pitchers, Severino and John Gray in the National League wild card, I mean, these were two guys who I think, you know, threw really hard, were hyped up, and just stayed up in the zone, and that's where hitters are able to hit. And so I think, you know, if you were to give Severino the kind of the option of not pitching in a one-game playoff, I think he'd be able to kind of settle in, get comfortable, and make better pitches down in the zone on the edges of the plate and not get rocked as hard.
That's interesting. I'm not sure he's going to struggle that much in a second game. Again, he is playing the Indians, and they can really rake. But I think having been rocked is going to help him in a way. He's not going to – I think he'll pitch looser than he would have in the wild card game because that was his first career playoff start.
Exactly.
Well, once you get beyond starters, I'm going to throw out one X factor we have right now, which is don't fall behind in this series because both of these bullpens are as good as it gets.
I think that's going to be the most exciting matchup. Is to kind of see the arms that are coming in at the end of this game. So if you're in a situation where it's a run-run or two-run ball game, whatever team is down, I mean, man, it's going to feel like a mountain to have to climb to get over that run deficit.
Yeah, we already saw how good the Yankees were last night. Well, two nights ago if you're listening to the podcast. But they basically got their... They literally got their starter chased in the first inning with one out and were able to string together bullpen arms to carry them all the way to victory. And they didn't even bring in Aroldis Chapman until the ninth inning. Yeah, and David Robertson is going to have to throw 52 pitches, a career high.
Which is impressive because I think if you were to sit here and say, hey, look, we're going to have to bring Chad Green in the first inning and we're going to have to bring David Robertson in the third inning, like you're sitting there going, yeah, I think you're sitting there going, oh, man, the Yankees are in trouble. And for the most part, nah, they were in control of that game.
Do you think all the pitches thrown by Chad Green and David Robertson in particular is going to come back and bite them in this series? Or do you think they're going to get enough time off in the first couple games that they will get the rest they need?
Well, see, that's the thing. I think Tanaka, well, I think they're going to start with Sonny Gray, right? Sonny Gray is going to be the game one starter for them?
I believe so.
I know Tanaka has done a pretty good job, and Sonny Gray, ever since coming over from the A's, has been a very effective pitcher for them. So you're looking at two guys who can hopefully lighten the load on the bullpen and help them recover from that extended bullpen, if you will, that was the wild card series. So I think the Yankees are actually in pretty good position to kind of save that bullpen and be okay. But at the same time, I do think if you're going to tax the bullpens, I think the Yankees bullpen would suffer more because they seem to fit more into the rigid rules that we come to expect of having a guy who's a seventh inning guy, an eighth inning guy, and a ninth inning guy who are used to working one inning, where the Indians have a much more fluid bullpen situation where they're willing to throw out their best guys and then bring in their closer, Cody Allen, who's been fantastic.
Right. The Indians, it's not just Cody Allen, though. It's Andrew Miller and Brian Shaw. Craig Breslow is a great pitcher out of Yale. Lefty, he doesn't throw hard at all, but he's got great command. He's pitched very well for the Red Sox in the past on their miracle playoff run in 2013. They've also got Dan Otero, who's been very good this year, rocking a 2.85 ERA in 60 innings pitched. We saw how good this bullpen was last year, especially Andrew Miller. He can come in and take over games and just shut down an offense. You know, he's another guy in that swingman role we talked about earlier. He's the best. All right, Josh. X-Factor time. We already mentioned don't lose the lead leading into the bullpens. Do you have another X-Factor for me?
Well, I mean, I think the easiest one to nail in this entire series and probably the entire playoffs, when you do want to talk about X-Factor, is Jose Ramirez for the Indians. I mean, I think there's the obvious candidates of, you know, who needs to succeed for this team to do well, you know, starting with Francisco Lindor. Jason Kipnis, hopefully you think, you know, coming back from injury, he's able to kind of produce. But the ability to have Jose Ramirez, who very, very, very deservingly is in the AL MVP conversation, and having the flexibility to kind of put him at second base, put him at third base, and then, you know, play matchups as necessary. And if I'm not mistaken, he's a switch hitter, correct? Oh, man, what a valuable trait to have, especially in this kind of condensed environment. So I think that's a dude who, like, hey, look, if he comes out and he produces, that makes everyone's job a hell of a lot easier.
And he was great for the Indians in the playoffs last year in their run to the World Series. This is a guy who not only has been there, he has actually done that.
I think that's when we actually decided to hear about him, even though he had had a pretty successful season last year, and that's why he was earning the playtime. I think that was the first time most non-Midwestern fans had heard about the exploits of Jose Ramirez.
All right, Josh, we're getting about that time toward the end of the podcast. I think it's time for some predictions. Tell me who you're going to be putting in the ALCS this year and how are they going to get there?
Well, it sounds funny, but I think the one that I'm most confident about is the Houston Astros, and I think they're going to win in four games. I think the Red Sox are a talented team. I think they have pieces there that could potentially upset them, but I think for the most part, the Astros are just a better team. You know, they got off to such a hot start during the season. They didn't really have to show very much at the end of the season. They had to kind of play to make sure nobody got injured. They did that successfully. And, you know, they're really in a prime position to make a run. In the other series, it's a little bit tougher for me. I am going to lead towards the favorites. I'm going to lead towards the Indians. I think that game might actually go the full five games, and that's simply because the Yankees have a very potent lineup, and I think it's very possible for them to get hot for one or two games and kind of extend this out. But when you look at the pitching that the Indians have, it's very, very, very hard to see the Yankees being able to put up three offensive outputs that would secure this series for them.
I think I'm going to agree with you a little differently. My head, and it pains me to say this, actually says the Astros in three. Calling the sweep because I don't think Chris Sale has been particularly sharp as of late, and I don't have the highest confidence that he's going to be able to bounce back against a team as talented as the Astros. I don't think Drew Pomeranz can beat Dallas Keuchel, and when you're choosing for the third game between Eduardo Rodriguez, Doug Fister, and Rick Porcello, not last year's Rick Porcello, but this year's Rick Porcello, that doesn't inspire a lot of confidence no matter who the Astros throw out. And on the other side, I'm going to go with the Indians in four. I think they're my World Series pick right now. They've been playing the best of anybody. They're hot, they're loose, they're as confident as anybody. And they just have everything necessary to win the World Series and take down the Yankees. But my heart is kind of longing for the days of those early 2000s ALCS dogfights with the Red Sox and the Yankees. 2004. They played three times in the Pedro Martinez years. Red Sox won once. All of them went seven games.
Straight dogfights.
Yeah, that was about as good as baseball, as entertaining as baseball got in our youth.
I mean, the Indians for me this year it's the fact that they have decided to run out the same team that got them to the World Series last year, except better and deeper. So it's kind of, you know, it's really hard to pick against them. I think up until maybe about 2 months ago, I was feeling the Astros as kind of the AL pick to reach the World Series. And it might sound silly that I've been swung by the winning streak they've gone on, but I've also been swung by the fact that, you know, they're actually finally healthy and have all their pieces now. And it looks like they're poised to, you know, just run through the league like they did last time in October. So I feel like it'd be silly to kind of go against them.
I feel like that'd be silly too. Anyway, Josh, I'll talk to you tomorrow night while we're watching the ALDS between the Yankees and the Indians. We'll talk about the NLDS series. Looks like we're going to get the Nationals and the Cubs, which is going to be a dangerous pick for me living in Chicago. And we're going to get the Dodgers
versus the Diamondbacks, who managed to put the game away 11-8, which, God, I mean, good God, these wildcard games have been fantastic. They've just been so entertaining.
So much fun.
Archie Bradley triple. Let me just throw that out there.
Those words make me giggle. Anyway, Josh, I got to get to editing. You got to get to sleep because it's midnight on the East Coast. I'll talk to you tomorrow, buddy.
All righty. More baseball. Get excited.
More baseball.